Welcome to the Moms in Prayer podcast, a place where we put our finger on the pulse of what's happening in the world today so we can better pray for and equip the next generation. Our focus will always be revival and spiritual awakening in our children, our schools, and our motherhood. We're so glad you're here with us. Let's get started. Hi, friends. I'm your host, Lene Heiss, and this is episode 73 of the Moms in Prayer podcast. It's hard to believe we're in mid-October. This fall is speeding right past us, isn't it? It's such a gift to bring you guests who empower, encourage, and equip you as you stand in the gap for our kids in schools. Today, we're going to take a good look at one of the spots that aches in our community, and we do so knowing that you will pray and move as you feel led. Today's guests are our new friends, Mike and Kristen Berry of Honestly Adoption Podcast. Mike and Kristen are a powerful voice for both foster care and adoptive families doing the hard work of helping us find language and healing homes for the hurting kids all around us. Show notes for today's episode number 73 can be found on the Moms in Prayer website at momsinprayer.org. Now let's welcome Mike and Kristen to the podcast. Mike and Kristen Berry, welcome to the Moms in Prayer podcast.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
I am so excited for our friends on the other side of the earbuds to listen and get to know your hearts. Would you guys introduce yourself and your family to our audience?
All right. Well, we're Mike and Kristen Berry. We write at Confessions of an Adoptive Parent and also the Honestly Adoption podcast. We're a foster and adoptive family. We have been married for 20 years. We have 8 children, 4 grandchildren, 2 sons-in-law, and we were foster parents for 9 years. We had 23 children come through our home, and that's about it.
Oh, you forgot to say, we live on a farm.
We live on a farm.
We have a lot of miniature animals, a miniature donkey, 2 miniature horses.
Not a farm that sustains anything.
No,
it's just
no.
For
fun. It's a hobby farm, but it's fun. Yeah.
I totally get that. So I'm just to yep. north of you in West Michigan, and we currently live on a farm as well.
Yeah.
So I think that if our friends can't see you or have never seen you before, you're not old. As a matter of fact, you're my age and my husband's
Thank
age.
You.
So, I mean, barely 40, and you say you've been married 20 years, but you have kids and grandkids. So that just gives yes. you a totally wild story. I'm going to skip ahead and just go, how right. did this journey of adoption and foster care begin for you guys? How did you get here?
We have no idea. No idea. Yeah, I'm
just
kidding.
Woke up one day yeah. with a lot of kids. No, that's true.
Seems like that sometimes, right?
I totally get that.
I am actually from an adoptive family. My grandpa grew up in the foster care system. My grandma was adopted. My cousin was placed for adoption when she was born, and my youngest brother is adopted. And so for me, it was just very natural to think about becoming a foster and adoptive family. And for Mike, there was no story of adoption. And so that was, you know, for us, something we talked about from the time we were dating.
Yeah, it was actually, and this is kind of a crucial part of our story, going off of what Kristen just said. Again, I wasn't against adoption or foster care. I just didn't understand it because it wasn't a storyline in my family or in the area that I grew up, which was Southern Ohio. And so in our early conversations, I resisted pretty heavily because it wasn't a storyline, but I had grown up going to school with some kids who were in foster care, and they often had some extreme behaviors because of their trauma history. And I didn't understand that as a kid, you know, as a third or fourth grader. But then even growing older, when you come from a all biological family, you know, and you're parented the traditional way, as my parents parented me, you really don't understand the full scope of it, of what's happening and why certain things happen within the foster care system or on the adoption journey. So to hear this was just like something totally foreign, which is always crazy for people to hear because we're such big advocates, and I'm such a big advocate now. You know, we run a company that provides resources and support and training for foster adoptive parents. To hear that that was our beginning, you know, Kristen always had the heart for it, was always in tune to it. It just took me some time and a heart change, which happened pretty quickly.
Let me ask you real quick, since we're in that direction, adoption foster care is really an all of us issue. It's not just mm-hmm. yeah. those who are growing up or have been exposed to that. Why is it an all of us issue, you guys?
I would say, for one, speaking of foster care, the goal of foster care is always reunification and family preservation. So many families become involved with the foster care system because they lack resources. So foster care is an everybody thing, because this could be your next door neighbor who is a single mom and lost her kids because, you know, maybe she was coping in a way that was not healthy for herself. Maybe she lacks mental health resources. Maybe her kids lack mental health resources and she lacks a support system. I think that's just a human condition, that often we don't know what's going on, the full story, what's going on behind someone else's door. And so foster care really does affect all of us because it's all around us. Families are struggling all around us. And so foster care becomes that last ditch effort to help a family. You can't tell by looking at someone if they're involved in the foster care system. You can't look at a person and know that they were adopted. And so I think this affects all of us because people in our own communities, in our own schools, in our own churches are really struggling. And, you know, sometimes you just can't tell by looking at someone, and they may be involved to the point of being in the foster care system, or you may be the person that is able to step in and offer that support to a single mom or dad and really avoid the foster care system. I think that's how it really affects all of us, is that need for support and community.
Well, as I was thinking about this particular show and having you guys as guests, I realized that virtually every school has kids from hard places inside of it. Families that are struggling and broken, and that Christians actually are often the ones who step up to help other families. And so as we look at this, this really is an all of us issue, because these families hurting around us need us, or we are that family that's struggling, and we've stepped into the gap for hurting kids. We'll talk more about finding language for our kids from hard places, but tell us your story. What was the first placement like, and how did that begin for you guys?
Our first experience with adoption was a private adoption, and that happened in 2002. And we had spent basically just 2 years with our baby girl, and she was kind of a perfect baby, you know, slept through the night right at the 3 month mark. And we were unprepared for our family to grow. And it was just, it was kind of, even though it spanned over a couple of months in terms of getting our license and all that, it was really kind of sudden in that we were asked by a person that went to our church who was working in a shelter in Indianapolis, if we could step in and care for a sibling group, a little boy, a little girl. It just seemed like all of a sudden we went from this family of just the three of us to now there are five of us. And it was shock. The kids were amazing. I don't want to confuse anybody here. These were beautiful babies that were placed in our care, and we loved every second of it, but we were really, really unprepared for the ups and downs of the foster care system. We were unprepared to be kind of the outside, on the outside looking in, because you had caseworkers working with attorneys, working with the judge, working with guardian ad litems. And we were kind of standing there. It was like they were in this huddle discussing the children that we were caring for. And we were on the outside, the ones who are actually caring for the children and really the foremost experts on the children, because they are in our care day in and day out. That was kind of hard. That left us exhausted often. And then to add to that, we just did not understand how kids from hard places, their behavior reflects unmet needs. And we didn't know that back then. This was in 2004. I look back on those days and where we are now compared to then, it's night and day. And there were a lot of things we did wrong, a lot of mistakes we made. We've learned from that, thankfully. But it was hard because there were just a lot of things we didn't understand. And there were a lot of things that we were really confused by. Back then, we had a lot of questions and very few to no answers. Yeah. Precisely why we wrote the last book we wrote, Honestly Adoption, because we wanted to answer as many questions as possible, because we wished we would have had this book in 2002, 2003, 2004, and the years that followed. So,
why do you think we need to find language, Kristen? Like, you're saying things that those of us who have adopted or are in the adoption community know and understand, but there's like a different vernacular. Like, kids from hard places. Tell us about that and finding words to describe things that a lot of people just don't understand.
Yeah, I think that language is ever growing, you know, beginning from birth. You know, we're always learning new words and better ways of communicating things. The reason that we're using a term like kids from hard places or children who have experienced trauma, children who have been exposed to prenatal trauma, you know, why do we learn that language? It's because the more that we learn, the better prepared we are to support our kids well. What we maybe see on the outside or what other people see when they look at our family, they may see something that they would term good or bad. And it's not good or bad. Our children are humans who've experienced some really incredibly difficult things. And when we use the proper language to describe what's happening with our children, we are bringing dignity to the situation. We are communicating dignity to the larger community. And we have to be really careful in how we do that. You know, sometimes I want to shake somebody at church and say, do you have any idea what happened to my child? Well, I can't do that because that's my child's private story. So I have to come up with other ways to advocate for my child well. And some of that is teaching the people around me to use language that is kind and compassionate and caring and descriptive. If I say something like, my child struggles with executive functioning, well, what that might look like to someone else is my child is flaky and never does what they're supposed to do. Except who wants to be called, you know, flaky and disobedient? When we learn that it's an executive functioning disorder, then we have a reason. It would be like saying the child who has no legs is just being lazy in PE class. We wouldn't call that child lazy. We would say, you know, this child needs an adaptation to be able to function in PE. So we're going to use the proper language around our kids. And I know I said it already, but I do stress that in the last 20 years, we're learning new things all the time. And we're learning from the larger community. We're learning from biological parents, birth parents, first parents, listening, learning from our own kids who may say, look, I don't like that term anymore, or I don't want you to call my first mom birth mom anymore. I want you to call her first mom. You know, there's always growth that needs to happen. And so in no way do I think that we have the language all figured out, but we are trying every day to use different language that is appropriate to our situation.
I think that's so well said. And I didn't prep you guys for this question, but one of the things that I've learned in our journey is that we call kids that are adopted or taken in foster care, we have this understanding that there's been trauma that's occurred, even if it's a clean cut adoption and it happened at the hospital and they've never known anybody but you, we have to understand that trauma has occurred. Can one of you speak into that just a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you just said is absolutely on point. We travel the country all year long, hosting trainings, participating in trainings. And one of the key things that we talk about in the very first section of that training, which is all about how trauma changes the brain, we talk about how, number one, everyone has experienced trauma. We all have. And it would be acute trauma. So it may be a scary one-time event or something along those lines. But then we relate that really quickly to our children who have trauma histories. And we talk very specifically about how every child who has been adopted, whether it's a private adoption, whether it was adopted through foster care, international adoption, has experienced a measure of trauma. So even the child who was privately adopted has gone through the trauma of loss, you know, loss of a first mom, a first dad, a first family, the trauma of spending 9 months in the womb of one human being, growing accustomed to her voice, growing accustomed to her surroundings, and now in the care of another human being who has a totally different surrounding. So it's really easy on this journey. We see this all the time with clients we work with, people we coach. There's this misunderstanding that, oh, they're a clean slate. They were a baby when this happened. Nope, not the case. You know, we know, you know, from neurofeedback that that is not how the brain functions, that our synapses captures like a photograph. And now we may not articulate it, but our behavior down the road is a window into the past. You have children who remember being neglected, but that early attachment disruption has now caused some survival behaviors later on. So I hope that hits the question that you were answering, because I'm kind of I get really deep into this. But yeah, to understand that there is a level of trauma, regardless of where our kiddos have come from, helps us to regear how we parent, helps us to change our approach. And thus that transforms our journey.
Well, I think that hit right at it. And as a ministry at Moms in Prayer that prays for children in schools, we know that there are kids who are dealing with trauma, whether they've been removed from their family or not, every single day. I wonder what that could look like. If you, Kristen, could explain what we might see on the outside and be missing what's going on the inside.
Right. I think particularly when you think about school, you may see a child that looks greedy. You know, if we're talking to moms who are volunteering for the class party, and you've got the child that comes up into the snack line and grabs 5 cookies and shoves 4 of them in their pocket and 1 in their mouth, and they haven't even made it back to their desk yet. That looks a little rude. That looks a little greedy. But knowing that beneath the surface, that our bodies carry these memories of something else that's happened in life, that child may have had food insecurities. That child may have been starving at some point in their life. And when those snacks come out, that is their survival instinct taking over. Now, this could even be you came in for the school Halloween party or fall party, and you brought those little plastic spider rings, and they've taken 5 of those and shoved them in their pocket, you know, and you're thinking, oh, you can't eat those. You know, this clearly isn't a survival skill. But remembering that our brains are storing that kind of trauma, and that survival instinct overrides any type of rational thinking. No, I can't eat the plastic spider rings that somebody brought for the costume party, but I'm always feeling like I might not have enough. A child that has experienced trauma might be your class clown. That might be their, you know, their coping. So as long as I'm the silly one, nobody will know that I haven't learned to read yet. As long as I'm being the class clown, as long as I'm being crazy, nobody will notice that I haven't had a bath all week. Those are two that pop into my mind, you know, but those drama responses often look like disobedience. Yeah. And so yeah. I think there was...
I was just going to say, you know, we are, you know, as I'm now trying to run through the list too, you know, you have the disobedience, you have the defiance, the disrespect, but you also, and you already said silly, but you have the avoidant, you have the closed off, the quiet, the child who can just bat their eyes at you and you just think this is the cutest little child on the planet. And you don't even realize that you're being manipulated, but it's not a manipulative child. It's a child that's learned to survive through manipulation. It's a child that's learned to survive through charming. You said it earlier, Kristen, or just a moment ago when you said, I'm going to do this. I'm paraphrasing, but you said, I'm going to do this so that people don't realize that I don't know something. So it's laying out cover fire to disguise what is really going on. And it could be loss. It could be something they don't know. We have seen this over the years with children who they are attack first, attack, 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 attack. And you think, oh my gosh, what's going on? What is wrong with you? And that tends to be our default response. But when you take a step back and remind yourself, there's a bigger picture going on here. And this present behavior is actually an indication of past trauma. Mm-hmm. Then you can start to ask the questions, okay, what is really going on here? There is an origin. I just said this a couple of weeks ago with a group that I was training. There is an origin for all human behavior, good or bad. So if we're happy, there's an origin for it. If we're frustrated, there's an origin. If we're anxious, there is an origin. And that is ever so true with our kids too. Reminding ourselves that because there's an origin for all behavior, that this behavior we're seeing, it's an indication of something bigger that's going on.
Mm-hmm. I think too, we all behave this way. You know, when we look back through, well, why was I so grouchy this morning and slammed the door on the way out to work. It's because I was worried about something. It's because I didn't have a good night's sleep. It's because I stubbed my toe. Even as adults, we have reasons that we respond the way we do, or reasons that we behave the way we do. I do want to bounce back a little bit to the charming behavior, especially because we are talking to moms in the context of, you know, being in the school and being with larger groups of children, supporting children well. I want to go back to the charming behavior because this one is very tricky. You know, our children who sometimes have that hugging every volunteer that comes into school and trying to sit on the teacher's lap and smiling brilliantly, and they're just a doll. It feels lovely to be with them. If we can remember that sometimes that child has experienced trauma and that child is interviewing for a new parent, when I can filter it through that context, I can respond in a safer way with that child. I bring that up because this is one of the trickiest things that we come in contact with children who have experienced trauma. If we're not careful, we can reinforce the idea that that type of behavior is safe, even with strangers. And while I'm background checked to go into my child's school, I know that I'm not going to traffic any children from my son's third grade class. That child is at greater risk for being in danger with neighbors, people in the community, and at some point, unfortunately, human trafficking, unhealthy relationships in the future. And so some of those things that we think are one thing, the charming kid is just lovely, the argumentative kid is just a jerk. Usually there is something else going on. The narrative that's going on inside that child's head is something very different from what we're seeing in a classroom or in a Sunday school class or the church.
Well, I want to ask you, how would you encourage moms of typical kids to teach their kids and also pray for these other families and teachers that are going in? What are some things? I mean, we're a prayer ministry. Make this practical for us. That's the focus we have. What are we praying specifically?
Yeah, I would start with when we're talking with our children and they're describing something that's happening with another person or another child. I think it's important to encourage our kids to understand themselves and how they respond to things first. So when you feel sad, what does that look like? How does your body feel? What do you usually do? So your child might say something like, you know, every time I feel sad, I feel it right here in my chest, or my arms feel tingly and I just want to climb under my covers and cry. When you feel frustrated, what do you do? So as your children understand their own bodies, they're going to be able to understand someone else. Now, when that child is having a conversation with you like, I just can't stand little Johnny. He's just a jerk and I don't want to go out on the playground with him anymore. He took my toy. Helping our kids to understand their own reaction to that, but then to start asking the questions. What do you think Johnny's feeling? What do you think happened before that? Can you think of any reasons why Johnny might have felt frustrated on the playground today? It's incredible to watch our kids really open up to others as they begin to understand themselves, then really to start to use that different language. So, well, maybe Johnny felt dysregulated because he didn't have a good night's sleep last night. Well, maybe I noticed that Johnny doesn't ever have any toys when we're supposed to bring show and tell. I bet he felt really sad about that. Whatever the scenario is. Interestingly, our kids can usually come up with some pretty accurate ideas about what's going on. So I think those are the conversations we have with our kids, and we open that up to prayer. That should just be a natural part of our conversation as parents. So tonight, let's pray together about how you were feeling on the playground and that you'll be able to set good boundaries for yourself. Let's also pray about Johnny. What do you think we could pray about with Johnny? When we're talking about, you know, how can we encourage moms to pray for kids who are experiencing trauma? How can we encourage our teachers? I really think that the prayer that I am praying is that our teachers, our volunteers, our teachers' aides, our administrators will see clearly what's happening. Very often we're stuck on the surface. You know, that kid is just so disagreeable. And my prayer is that the people who work with vulnerable children will see below the surface. What am I really looking at? And I think that the Lord can really open our eyes to see those around us more clearly, and not just kids. I think as we have learned more, we've started to look at the adult in the grocery store that's having a little adult-sized meltdown because her coupons won't work, you know?
Yep.
Opening our eyes to what's below the surface. What just happened? Is anything else going on with this woman? And the truth is, probably she didn't wake up today and say, I'm going to make everyone's life miserable with my coupons that don't work. The truth is, every person that's exhibiting an undesirable behavior is actually experiencing something else on the inside.
Totally. Mike, I bet you have this too. I often get to a meeting with a teacher who has no idea what they're looking at when they're dealing with my special needs child, and they feel like they're supposed to be the expert to meet those needs. So I'm often going, we need creativity here, Lord, because we don't know what to do. I bet, first of all, you've had those experiences, but also you've had those same conversations with teachers. So tell me a little bit about that and what that conversation looks like, because we know teachers are having those conversations all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that we've learned to do with teachers in particular, and I will say this, we have had some extraordinary teachers over the years.
Us too.
Many of them were not clued in to children who have trauma histories, how that impacts their present behaviors, right? But here's the most valuable thing about those teachers. They were willing to learn. So for any teachers that are listening, you don't have to have all the answers, but if you are willing to learn from the foremost experts, and I consider parents to be the foremost experts on their kids, if you're willing to learn, that is a game changer. The thing that I have personally learned to do, and I do it a lot, is in my early days of life, probably the first 20 some years, almost 30 years of life, I spent a lot of time talking and interrupting and trying to insert truth or the right perspective. And what I've learned now is that the best approach is to stop and listen first, because I think that everybody wants to be validated. And I think that teachers are professionals. Teachers, principals, guidance counselors, they are professionals. They are people who have spent, some of them, a lot of years in school to earn what they have earned. And they're also tired. And my child is not the only child that they are dealing with on a daily basis. And so I've really learned, going into IEP meetings or parent-teacher conferences, to listen first. And then when the timing is right, to ask if I could share some things that would be helpful to them. Because the focus needs to be on helping them become a better teacher, not trying to teach them. Because oftentimes professionals don't want to be in that position. So I think the best approach possible is listen first, but then also come at it with this spirit of, I want to help you succeed in your classroom. And not in a condescending way, but with my child. I want you to succeed with my child, but also,
how can I support you to support my child?
But I also want you to succeed with all children, right? And almost always there's this response of absolutely. I mean, we went in this year before school even started and sat down with the resource teacher and the teacher of record and walked them through exactly what they will experience with our child. And it was extremely helpful to them. And here's the other thing we've learned. We've learned this from Kristen's dad, who is a retired middle school principal and now has a PhD and teaches other principals, that they welcome this communication. They welcome parents, principals, teachers, guidance counselors. We often think, oh, they're so busy, I'm just going to be bothering them if I ask to have a meeting with them. No, they actually want that, because they want to know how to care for your child the best way possible. So we also bring lots of literature. We have lots of research, lots of partners that provide lots of really good information. And we bring that with us. We email that. We've actually created a resource for parents that helps them help their teacher understand how trauma changes their child and what they need to know about that. So yeah, listen first. Give them the space to be the teacher, to be the professional, and then respond to them with this spirit of, hey, I want to help. I want to partner with you. I don't want to be at odds. Not that they would be, but I don't want to be at odds with you. I want to partner with you. I want to help you do the best job possible with your class, but also with my child, and succeed. Yeah, we've actually had a lot of experience with this over the last 15 years.
And I think it's just become really important over the last few years as we've met as parents with teachers and special needs liaisons and therapists and that kind of thing to just realize we're on the same page. And especially as Christian parents, we can view a lot of this as spiritual issues too and recognize that we have a God who leans in and wants to help. So
yeah,
I think that's really fun. We're coming to the end of our time together, but I wonder what you would say to the woman who's listening who believes God might be calling her to adoption and foster care.
Well, I think that if you feel that the Lord is leading you to foster care and adoption, then that's probably a good indication that you are being led to do something with foster care and adoption. So the first thing that I would advise anybody to do is to research. And as you do your research, ask for the Lord's guidance. The truth is, you know, I really believe that you end up where you're supposed to be. So start calling around. What are some things you can do? Support foster families that are already in your community. Get to know the needs that are out there. You may envision something for yourself. You may say, you know, the Lord is calling me to foster, you know, a 3.5-year-old little boy. And I am here to tell you that a 16-year-old teenage girl is going to show up on your doorstep. But it's never what you thought that you were supposed to do exactly. Yep. But the Lord really brings you to the place that you're supposed to be. I have full confidence in that. So open your heart up to it. Do your research. And as you're researching, keep your heart open to say yes to the things that the Lord puts in front of you.
Why do Christian families in particular need to step up to this task?
I would say all families, but I think that as Christian families, there is a call to serve the world and be love to the world and be hope to the world, because we carry a light with us that is the true light. It's the true hope for humanity. And I think that we also carry the responsibility of modeling. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of situations over the last several years in particular that I don't think the church has done the best job at modeling what true hope really is and what true light really is. And my good friend and actually a member of our team, he's our podcast producer, Matt, has this phrase that he often uses, and that's called light bearer. In fact, I think he's even created an entire free download or online course on being a light bearer. And every time he uses that term, it always hits me. I'm like, what a great description for who we are to be to this world, a light bearer. And I think that also frees us up from trying to be God in certain situations, because I think we have, as human beings, we have this tendency to become too big for our britches, and suddenly we feel like it's our responsibility to do God's job, and that's not our responsibility. But being a light bearer is what we're called to do. And so things like caring for vulnerable children, bringing hope to broken families who have been broken. Because if you're a foster parent, like Kristen said in the beginning, the goal is reunification. So realistically, your goal is to help a family heal until there is a moment where the courts may say that family will not be restored in that manner, right? But your goal is to help that family heal. So we're called to care for vulnerable children, to bring hope to the world, to be a light bearer. I think that's why people of faith need to step up. And that doesn't necessarily mean you are going to get your foster care license and be a foster care provider. It doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to be the person that adopts a child or children. It may mean that you take on, you become the light bearer that supports these families. We have a good friend, our good friend Jason Johnson talks all the time about how we may not all be called to be actually hands-on, but everybody is called to do something. Yeah. And I think if you are a person of faith, you are called to do something. You are called to do something with nearly everything in this world, right? There is no part of being a Christ follower that exists on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I don't think you're really a follower if you're on the sidelines.
Yeah.
You're either in it or you're not. And so that is never more true than with vulnerable children and broken families.
Well, I know that a lot of people say, your child is so lucky. Your child is so lucky to have you. And I want to say, only God is a rescuer, number one. If you're getting into foster care or adoption or working with special needs kids or kids from hard places, only God is their rescuer. But we get to participate in their healing if the Lord lets us. And that's just...
Yeah, absolutely.
Such a gift. Mike and Kristen, first of all, your podcast is a gift. Just this morning, I sent out to 5 of my friends who have kids from hard places. And I was like, this episode right here. And I just shot actually 2 of them. And also your book, Honestly Adoption, is terrific. It's bite-sized answers to, is it 100 questions?
It's 101.
101. I was off for it by one. It's so digestible too. And I think it's something that people can, whether they are parents of adopted kids or they work with kids from this place or they go to church with kids from these places. Yeah. This is a great resource, you guys. Wondering if one of you would mind praying for us as we end our time together for the moms who are listening who have just heard this brand new vernacular for the first time.
Well, I'm going to let the mom do it.
All right.
I'm going to punt to Kristen.
Kristen, who is the mom and grandma, but doesn't look like she's old enough to be hardly either. So yeah, Kristen, will you pray for us?
Thank you. Father, thank you so much for each of these listeners, for the opportunity to learn more about supporting children well. We know that each one of us belongs to you, and particularly these vulnerable children. They belong to you and they are precious to your heart. Father, I pray that as each one of us listens today, that you will place on our hearts the name of someone, something that we can do to support someone well, to support another family well. We thank you for all that you've done and for laying your life out for us. It's in your name we pray. Amen.
Thanks, you guys. Oh, Lord, help us reach the kids that are hurting in our midst. And Lord, keep upholding our families that are stepping into the gap. Leave us a note, share today's episode, or hashtag Moms in Prayer, at Moms in Prayer, or at Lee Meanheist, so that we can have a conversation about today's tough topic. We love to hear from you. Just a reminder that our show notes for today's episode and more about today's guest is found at the blog at momsinprayer.org. Moms are making the difference. Moms who see needs beyond behavior. Moms just like you. See you next week.